This is the second in a series of encounters between Hafez and Dante. The third will follow later this winter on the subject of beauty, and the first one was on the sigh. So to introduce the event, the evening, I just wrote a few notes and quotes on the gaze. Who can fix a limit to the gaze? Who will dare to define its scope, point out its center, or draw a circle around its sphere? As far as I can see, everyone turns away. Where? To the gaze. On the one hand, the gaze is limitless, extending in all directions, further than the eye can see. The self, says Ibn Arabi, is an ocean without shore. Gazing upon it has no end in this world and the next. On the other hand, the gaze is nothing, nothing but itself, a zero through which only another eye is looking. All creatures are absolutely nothing, says Johannes Tauler. That which has no being is nothing, and creatures have no being, because they have their being in God. If God turned away for a moment, they would cease to exist. Is my gaze my own? Yes and no. I look, yet cannot see myself. I am seen, yet none sees me. Is that you, looking back at yourself in the mirror? No and yes. The gaze is the mirror of the gaze, every look a reflection of itself. Where would I be? What would become of you? Everything, if that which sees and is seen by seeing, vision's own visibility, were blotted out, blinded. If the gaze through which we gaze shut its eyes. That's what would happen.
Good thing I was looking at you.
Do not separate.
I was gay.
Do not separate from me, says Hafez, for you are the light of my vision. You are the peace of my soul and the intimate of my heart. I see that one is always turning toward and turning away from what one turning toward what one turns away from. What an endless revolution, the restless conversion of the still, ever-spinning eye. Zoom in on planet pupil, a little nothing meaning all, suspended in its own universal reflection, projecting and filming everything through the point, the navel of itself. Is your gaze born from you, or you from your gaze? I believe, says Dante in Paradiso, because of the sharpness of the living ray that I sustained, that I would have been lost if my eyes had turned away from it. Admit it, the gaze is really too much. Who can withstand it? No one shall see me and live. That must be why Narcissus never stops spontaneously lying to himself about his reflection, never ceases to fall in love with his own image, seeing neither that it is an image nor his. If you are me, then who am I? And if I am me, then who are you? Perpetual predicament of the illusion that sustains reality. As Meher Baba once rhymed, spontaneously, "Oh, you ignorant, all-knowing soul, what a plight you are in. Oh, you weak, all-powerful soul, what a plight you are in. Oh, you miserable, all-happy soul, what a plight you are in. What a plight, what a sight, what a delight." How eternally precious those passing moments when the gaze opens itself a little more and sees by some unfathomable magic or trick of the abyss, which if you gaze long into it, gazes back into you. That's Nietzsche. How precious that the image is no less in love with Narcissus. As Francis Brabazon said, "And so one arrives at the painful conclusion that the beloved alone exists, which means that oneself doesn't." And that's a terrible predicament to find oneself in. For one is still there. The only solution I found was to accept the position, you alone are and I am not, but we are both here. Whose gaze is that? What eye calmly turns itself toward the gaze of the real, penetrating the sight of life, which is death to the living? It would seem as if the person who possesses this look also cannot sustain it. Are not saints or the truly beautiful forever ashamed of their own eyes? Here is a passage from Meher Baba to fall in love with. A wali, or saint, he says, has the power to open the third eye and grant divine sight, if he is in the mood. He can do so by simply looking into the eyes of the aspirant, even if the aspirant is at a distance. When the third eye is opened, all is light. It is so powerful an experience that the recipient either goes mad or drops the body. One type of wali is called artad. They are very, very few, quite rare. They are very fiery, with piercing eyes that break through anything, even mountains. Their gaze is sufficient to cut an animal in two. Hence, they always keep their eyes on the ground. That, too, is split apart. If the gaze splits, surely that is because it is without number, because the manyness of our eyes only sees by reflecting one. Thus, the individual neither sees nor is seen by unity without being cut in two. Consider this as the principle of honesty, or natural self-discernment. I am only whole, authentic, truthful when I see how double, how dark to myself I am, when I see myself seen by seeing itself. Look not upon me, it says in the Song of Songs, because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. Imagine a map of all vision, a long tracing of its every line, individual and collective, from the beginningless beginning to the endless end, from the earliest emergence of anything to its final absolute evaporation. A one-to-one map, scaled to the continuum of seeing itself, all of its sleeps and wakings, every stop and start across the seas of every kingdom of being, in short, from stone to human. What does it look like? In his dialogue on the two principal systems of the world, Galileo, in order to explain how this motion in common, that is the motion of the earth, remains as if non-existent to everything that participates in it, conceives the figure of an artist who draws without separating pen and paper everything he sees while sailing from Italy to Turkey. If an artist had begun drawing with that pen on a sheet of paper when he left the port and had continued doing so all the way to Alexandretta or Iskenderun, he would have been able to derive from the pen's motion a whole narrative of many figures, completely traced and sketched in thousands of directions with landscapes, buildings, animals, and other things. Yet the actual real essential movement marked by the pen point would have been only a long line. Long indeed, but very simple. But as to the artist's own actions, these would have been conducted exactly the same as if the ship had been standing still. Is not the real hero of this story the hyper-saccadic story of the eye? Now raise that to the power of itself, ad infinitum. What a line. More locally, the gaze concerns the duration and depth of seeing, the extensity and intensity of its time and space. Gazing not only looks, but looks beyond looking, exploring the very surface of vision as a dimension otherwise than surface. The gaze sees by seeing into itself, in both senses at once. No need for a map, then, as the gaze directs itself. Or as Merleau-Ponty explains, the focus of the gaze, through which we establish the qualities of objects by interrupting them from the total life of the spectacle, operates through an essential reflexivity. He writes, "The sensible quality, far from being coextensive with perception, is the peculiar product of an attitude of curiosity or observation. It appears when, instead of yielding up the whole of my gaze to the world, I turn toward this gaze itself, and when I ask myself, what precisely is it that I see? It does not occur in the natural transactions between my sight and the world. It is the reply to a certain kind of questioning on the part of my gaze, the outcome of a second order or critical kind of vision which tries to know itself in its own particularity." The idea is you sort of see by trying to see what seeing is, and then things come into view. That's like the idea of focus, right? So we're led back willy-nilly to the essential gravity of the gaze as an exponent of the will, to looking as the weight of the love of a being who is its own self-consuming question. But what of the one whose will is annihilated? To those in whom the will has turned and denied itself, says Schopenhauer, this very real world of ours, with all of its suns and galaxies, is nothing. What does the gaze that sees nothing see? And Saul rose from the earth, and when his eyes were opened, he saw nothing. That's from Acts of the Apostles. I trust that both Dante and Hafez agree that this gaze sees not only nothing, but everything as well. As their contemporary Meister Eckhart says, a man who is established thus in God's will wants nothing but what is God's will and what is God, even though it meant the pains of hell, it would be joy and happiness to him. He is free and has left self behind and must be free of whatever is to come into him. If my eye is to perceive color, it must be free of all color. If I see blue or white color, the sight of my eye, which sees color, the very thing that sees, is the same as that which is seen by the eye. The eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me. My eye and God's eye, one seeing, one knowing, and one love. And this makes me want to see what these two poets might see looking into each other. For both are so well versed in the mystery of the unitive doubleness of vision experienced in the gaze, wherein the two-ness of the eyes become one. As Hadewich explains, the power of sight that is created as natural to the soul is charity. This power of sight has two eyes, love and reason. Reason cannot see God except in what he is not. Love rests not except in what he is. Reason has its secure paths by which it proceeds. Love experiences failure, but failure advances it more than reason. Reason advances toward what God is by means of what God is not. Love sets aside what God is not and rejoices that it fails in what God is. Reason has more satisfaction than love, but love has more sweetness of bliss than reason. These two, however, are of great mutual help, one to the other. For reason instructs love, and love enlightens reason. When reason abandons itself to love's wish, and love consents to be forced and held within the bounds of reason, they can accomplish a very great work, such as the Divine Comedy or the Divan Comedy. This no one can learn except by experience. And I'm looking forward to this encounter all the more, not only because, as Vernon Howard says, anything you look forward to will destroy you, as it already has, but because what is seen between the gazes of these two poets will no doubt be something neither could see. The beauty of a spark leaping between the eyes of two no ones. As Hafez says, Ale Nazar, do Alam, Yek Nazar, Bebozand. Men of sight can lose both worlds in one glance. Or as Love tells Dante in the Vita Nuova, Ego tanquam centrum circuli, tu autem non sic. I am the center of the circle. I am as the center of the circle. You are not. So in order to lose everything all over again for the first time, I will end my introduction.
Oh, that's a nice pun.
By reading the last poem from Ocean Seeping Eyes. Okay. Our bodies come or came off like light coats. Take your pick. If the present tense, this is an event. If past, a story. And if both, there's a chance at paradise of getting out of here real quick. So much to learn from the little moon. See her body move through all phases of itself without relinquishing either side of pupil being, fixed in the pure life circle of a swoon. Sages say corpora come and go as soul remains. Is that not your secret invisible sense of things, gazing the luna of your face into the forest from the window of a train? We look into a mirror to see what it sees, nothing. That is the nothing which everywhere gives sight to all, blinding one in inescapable vision, finding me before everything. Vertiginously dear are your words to me, as dear as the words you never say. The heart aims eternally at the threshold where one and zero both get to enjoy having it both ways. Nearby, on the verge where sound and body are one substance, this mouth sculpts itself into a megaphone receiver of the primal scream. Or was it another whispering in my dream? Now that we're finally here, let's tear away from ourselves with a daring no one has any idea of. Let us all swim free as pure air, like water evaporating from the tears of love. Thank you. So now I'll turn it over to Franco Marchandaro.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Dante's gaze. Let us turn our attention to some unique moments in the Vita Nuova, the new life, the youthful work written by Dante after the death of Beatrice in 1290, and later in his mature work and more widely known, the Divine Comedy, in which the figure of the gaze stands out as a heightened, as a sign of heightened creativity. The gaze, a secret, ultimately unfathomable language unto itself, like the sigh, the smile, the voice, or tears, is at once before and beyond language. That is, before and beyond discursive reasoning, like silent prayer. The second chapter of the new life opens with these words. I quote, "Nine times since my birth had the heaven of light returned to almost the same point in its orbit when to my eyes first appeared the glorious lady of my mind, who was called Beatrice. She appeared humbly and properly dressed in a most noble color, crimson, girded and adorned in the manner that befitted her so youthful age. At that moment I say truly that the spirit of life, which dwells in the most secret chamber of the heart, began to tremble so strongly that it appeared terrifying in its smallest veins, and trembling it said these words, 'Behold a God more powerful than I, who comes to rule over me.' At that point the animal spirit, which dwells in the upper chamber, to which all the spirits of the senses carry their perceptions, began to marvel greatly, and speaking especially to the spirits of sight, it said these words, 'Now has appeared your beatitude.' Love ruled over my soul," says Dante. "Many times he commanded me that I seek to behold this youthful soul. Sorry, this youthful angel. Thus many times in my childhood I sought her, and I saw in her such noble and laudable bearing that of her could certainly be said those words of the poet Homer, 'She seemed no child of mortal man, but of God.'" As we read this passage, we are struck by the way Dante speaks of the moment he first saw Beatrice, when he was nine and she was nearly nine, as he does not say that he saw Beatrice, but that she appeared to his eyes. He also speaks of his and her age in astronomical terms, thus emphasizing the objective reality of Beatrice's first appearance to Dante before such experience is internalized, and thus it is perceived not as a mere happening, but as an event, that of his vision of her, as he will state later, when he describes the inner drama of the spirit of life that trembling spoke of the God of love, and of the animal spirit that, marveling greatly, addressed its words, as we've seen, especially to the spirits of sight. Only after this drama has been played out does Dante, moved by love, to behold Beatrice, does Dante state that he saw her indeed. We should also note that Dante, as he recalls his first encounter with Beatrice as a child, also speaks of her as the glorious lady of his mind, that is, of Beatrice already dead and dwelling in heaven. Thus, Dante, poet and lover, as he introduces the beloved, reveals the intersection of the moment in time, the then of her appearance, and the eternal now of her dwelling in paradise. Hence, as he begins to select and transcribe passages that he reads in his book of memory, of which he spoke at the first chapter of the Vita Nuova, he often offers us a foretaste of his Poetics of the Gaze, which informs many pages of this work. In chapter 3 of Vita Nuova, we find the first example of the creative power of Beatrice's gaze. I quote, "After many days had passed, so that precisely 9 years were completed following the appearance described above of this most gentle lady, it happened that on the last of these days, this marvelous lady appeared to me dressed in purest white between two gentle ladies who were of greater years. And passing along a street, she turned her eyes to that place where I stood in great fear. And in her ineffable courtesy, which today is rewarded in life everlasting, she greeted me with exceeding virtue, such that I then seemed to see all the terms of beatitude." Of special significance in this scene of Dante's encounter with Beatrice, 9 years after her first appearance to him as one comparable to a child, is that Beatrice's gaze precedes and in a sense transcends her greeting directed to Dante. We might say that it is the first silent expression of her words before these take shape and are manifested. I should also note that here Beatrice's gaze does not meet Dante's gaze. But as Dante, the author, notes, she turned her eyes to that place where he stood in great fear. This suggests that as the poet and lover stands in fear as he gazes at the scene of Beatrice's appearing in the street of Florence, accompanied by two gentle ladies, is not able to direct his spirit of sight towards those of the beloved. Why? I think that he cannot, because he fears that such an encounter with the inner being manifested through the gaze of such an extraordinary lady, whose greeting seems to confer beatitude to him, would overwhelm him. He could not endure the vision of what Emmanuel Levinas has called the infinity of the other. These words by T.S. Eliot come to mind from Bert Norton, the first of his four quartets. I quote, "Go, go, go," said the bird. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." Indeed, think for a moment. How long can each one of us here can sustain or endure gazing into each other's eyes before we feel uncomfortable and feel compelled to turn our gaze away from very much reality, the infinity of the other? Dante discovers a new way of experiencing the beatitude once conferred to him by his beloved's greeting by singing her praises and directing them not only to Beatrice, but to a larger audience, a community of ladies endowed with a noble heart, a cor gentil, beginning with a chorus of those ladies whom he addresses with the words of the famous canzone, "Donne che avete intelletto d'amore," ladies who have understanding of love, which marks the beginning of a new poetics, the poetics of praise, la poetica della lode. In the following excerpt, as extracted from this complex, rich canzone, is chapter 19 now of the Vita Nuova, we shall discover woven in this new poetics, the poetics of the gaze. And thus a new measure of the larger economy of the salvific power of Beatrice's presence, which transcends the earlier narrow economy, whereby her greeting was defined for its power to confer beatitude mainly on Dante. I quote, "The lady is desired in highest heaven. Now I wish to have you know of her virtue," says Dante. "I say, let who wishes to appear a gentle lady go with her, for when she goes along the way into villainous hearts, love casts a chill, whereby all their thoughts freeze and perish, and who might suffer to stay and behold her would change into a noble thing or die. And when she finds someone worthy to behold her, he experiences her power, for what she gives him turns into salvation, and so humbles him that he forgets every offense. God has given her an even greater grace than one cannot end in evil who has spoken to her. Of her says love, the God of love, a mortal thing, how can it be so adorned and pure? He then looks at her again and within himself swears that God intends to make of her something new. From her eyes, however she moves them, issue spirits of love inflamed, which wound the eyes of whoever then beholds her, and pass through so that each finds the heart. You see love depicted in her face, there where none may behold her steadily. End of quote. As we read these verses, we are first struck by the absence of any reference to Dante, the poet and lover's role as one who beholds Beatrice, or is the object of her salvific gaze. Emphasis instead is given to the following actors in what can be perceived as a little drama. The first actor is one who might suffer to stay and behold Beatrice, who would change into a noble thing or die. In light of the principle of analogy underlying this action, we may think of two passages from the book of Exodus, the Old Testament, Christian corner, the Hebrew Bible. In the first we read that Yahweh would speak with Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend, Exodus 33, etc. In the second, from the same chapter, a few verses below, we read, Moses said to Yahweh, show me your glory, I beg you. And God said, I will let all my splendor pass in front of you, and I will pronounce before you the name Yahweh. You cannot see my face, he said, for man cannot see me and live. The second actor is one in this little drama, is one whom Beatrice deems worthy to behold her, and to whom she confers the gift of salvation, whereby he is humbled that he forgets every offense. The third actor is the God of love, who, filled with wonder about Beatrice's miraculous salvific power, exclaims, a mortal thing, how can it be so adorned and pure? Significantly, he then looks at her again, and in a kind of inner dialogue with himself, speaks of God, with a capital G, who intends to make of Beatrice something new. That is a miracle. With this reference to God, who is infinite love, the God of love reminds us readers that what we earlier defined as a drama in human terms is in fact a theodrama, which we may now recognize retrospectively, has been announced by these verses. The lady is desired in highest heaven. So the perspective is already announced as being one heavenly, timeless. So the fourth character in what we have just defined as a theodrama is Beatrice. We now witness at once a phenomenology of the spirits of sight, which are at once a manifestation of a physical power of sight and of the spiritual, mystical power that speaks of them as spirits of love inflamed. Paradoxically, these spirits, as messengers of love, wound the eyes of whoever beholds Beatrice. And through these portals of being, they reach the hearts of the beholders as they at once see and are seen by her. We should note that this moment of union in love between two subjects, as each is the object of the other's gaze, is expanded to include a subject, the you of a chorus that includes each one of us now as subject of this phrase. You see love depicted in her, it's the impersonal you. You see love depicted in her face, there where none may behold her steadily. This is therefore a momentary, fleeting, an intermittent epiphany of love. This is manifested in the beloved's face. For as we say, we have already noted, humankind cannot bear very much reality. I'll skip a couple of pages, need a little pruning for brevity's sake. So the gaze, I will not gaze at those pages. In chapter 42, precedes the last chapter, the Vita Nuova, the New Life. It is now time to connect the comment on the sonnet that again speaks of a sigh in chapter 42. We read, and I quote, "Beyond the sphere that circles wider penetrates the sigh that issues from my heart. A new intelligence, which love, weeping, places in him, draws him ever upward. When he arrives where he desires, he sees a lady who receives honor and so shines that because of her splendor, the pilgrim spirit gazes upon her. He sees her such that when he tells me what he tells me of it, I do not understand him. So subtly does he speak to the sorrowing heart, which makes him speak. I know that he speaks of that gentle one, for he often remembers Beatrice. So that I understand him well, dear ladies." A close reading will reveal a process of transformation of a key term introduced in the prose, namely of Dante's thought, first into the figure of the sigh, then in the new intelligence placed in it by the weeping love as a prime mover, and then in the figure of the pilgrim spirit. The familiar conventional opposition between thought and hence discursive reason, language on one hand, and the unique language of the sigh on the other hand, is here transcended. The figure of the sigh is transformed into the pilgrim spirit that as a persona, or as its etymology tells us, in Latin persona means mask, so as a mask of Dante, poet and lover, now sees a lady who receives honor in heaven, and because of her splendor, it gazes upon her. This vision of Beatrice is ineffable. It transcends language and thus understanding. As such, it awaits or points to another vision, as we find announced but not yet represented in the last chapter of the Vita Nuova, which I read the following. "After this sonnet," says Dante, "there appeared to me a wonderful vision, in which I saw things that made me resolve to write no more of this blessed one until I could more worthily treat of her. And to arrive at that, I apply myself much as I can, as she truly knows, so that, if it be pleasing to him for whom all things live, that my life may last for some years, I hope to say of her what was never said of any other woman. And then may it please him, who is the Lord of the courtesy, that my soul may go to see the glory of this lady, namely, the blessed Beatrice, who in glory gazes upon the face of him, quid est per omnia saecula benedictus, who is for all ages blessed." As it is generally known, here Dante announces what later in his life, during his exile from Florence, will write his Divine Comedy. By the way, he never called it the Divine Comedy, he simply called it the Commedia. His Commedia, of his vision of hell, purgatory, and paradise, from which I shall now select a few salient examples of his poetics of the gaze. In the first canto of Inferno, which constitutes, together with the second canto, the prologue to the entire poem, Dante the poet constructs this scene of his encounter in his role as the wayfarer or pilgrim with the soul of the ancient poet Virgil. At the moment when as a she-wolf forces him to lose hope of climbing a hill that allegorically foreshadows the mountain of purgatory, at whose summit lies the Garden of Eden, the earthly paradise. This scene takes shape as the wayfarer is retreating down toward the dark wood of sin. So I read, "While I retreated," says Dante the poet, "while I retreated down to lower ground, before my eyes there suddenly appeared one who seemed faint because of long silence. When I saw him in that vast desert, 'Have pity on me,' were the words I cried." The original says, "Miserere di me." "Have pity on me," were the words I cried, "whatever you may be, a shade, a man." This scene emerges the moment the pilgrim is completely powerless, alone with his terror. It is important to note that here Dante does not say that Virgil appeared to him, or that he saw Virgil coming to his rescue. Here we find two separate and distinct scenes that are directly related. In the first, the new action that intersects the wayfarer's retreat towards the dark wood is initially represented as an objective happening, as we have already noted in the new life, before it is perceived as an event that is seen by him. Dante writes, dinanzi agli occhi mi si fu offerto chi per lungo silenzio parea fuoco. Before my eyes there suddenly appeared one who seemed faint because of the long silence. In the scene that follows, the act of seeing is expressed by the verb vidi, I saw. This reveals the subject's deeper awareness of what appears before his eyes, which significantly is intimately related to a keener perception of the background, the scenic dimension within which the poet appears, lo gran deserto, the vast desert. Of even greater consequence is the deep connection of the seeing with the assertion of the subject as he utters the words, miserere di me, have pity on me. These are the first words of the famous, most famous of the penitential psalms, number 51 of the, 51 of the Vulgate, in which we read, miserere mei Deus, in the Latin of St. Jerome, have mercy on me, O God. They are addressed by the psalmist to God, I repeat. Against the starkness of the grand desert, of the vast desert, we see two equally stark figures standing one before the other in absolute nakedness, one essentially absolutely defined by his misery and the other correspondingly by his pity, the misericordia that such pity calls forth. The poetic power of the words miserere di me is directly dependent on the perception or vision of the shade or living man as other, and not as many Dantisti still continue to read as Virgil. This entire scene would collapse if we imagine that the wayfarer's words were addressed to Virgil, or worse, to Virgil as the allegory of reason. The wayfarer's misery calls forth an invocation for help addressed to anyone who can act as God or like God, who as totally other remains hidden, Deus absconditus. As Hans Urs von Balthasar writes, I quote, God plays through human beings and ultimately as a human being. The good which takes place in God's action really is affected by the world's ambiguity and remains a hidden good. This good is something done. It cannot be contemplated in pure aesthetics, nor proved and demonstrated in pure logic. It takes place nowhere but on the world stage, which every living person's present moment and its destiny is seen in the drama of world history that is continually unfolding. End of quote. Another fitting commentary are Carl Carreni's remarks as he cites Pliny the Elder, Deus est mortali juvare mortalem, the fact that man helps another man is God to man. End of quote. This is from Pliny the Elder, the Roman author. A similar view is expressed by Levinas in his Of God Who Comes to Mind. And I quote from Levinas, the idea of the infinity in me or my relation to God comes to me in concreteness, in the concreteness of my relation to the other man or the other human being, in the sociality, which is my responsibility for my neighbor. End of quote. In light of these remarks, we now have a deeper understanding of Dante's representation of the scene of his encounter with the other, which reveals the fine distinction between what we perceive as a happening that appears to his eyes and his seeing it as an event that takes place for him, awakening in him a deeper awareness of his being in the world, especially his encounter and relationship with the other. In the second canto of Inferno, which together with the first canto constitute the poem's prologue, as I said a moment ago, there is a scene in which we find Virgil's revelation to Dante, the wayfarer, of Beatrice's appearance to him in Limbo, where within a noble castle, which is in a meadow of green, so it's a scene of a garden, of green flowering plants, he dwells along with noble spirits of antiquity, including Homer, Plato, Aristotle, and many others. this is where Beatrice leaves her seat, so to speak, in heaven, and descends to the part of hell which contains this area of limbo, this kind of a oasis, and beckons him to intervene to help Dante. So we find again the practice of the gaze in a moment. So says Virgil to Dante, the wayfarer, "I was among those souls who are suspended. A lady called to me, so blessed, so lovely, that I implored to serve at her command. Her eyes surpassed the splendor of the stars, and she began to speak to me so gently and softly, with angelic voice. She said, 'O spirit of the courteous Mantuan, whose fame is still a presence in the world, and shall endure as long as the world lasts, my friend, who has not been the friend of fortune, is hindered in his path along that lonely hillside. He has been turned aside by terror. Go now with your persuasive word, with all that is required to see that he escapes. Bring help to him that I may be consoled. For I am Beatrice who sent you on. I come from where I most long to return. Love prompted me, that love which makes me speak.'" After Virgil's response to Beatrice's pleadings on behalf of Dante, and after she reveals to him that she was sent by Lucy, was sent by Mary, who, as it is implied, was sent by God, who remains hidden, we find that Virgil evokes to Dante this scene. Says Virgil to Dante, "When she had finished with her words to me, she turned her gleaming, tearful eyes, which only made me hurry all the more. And just as she had wished, I came to you. I snatched you from the path of the fierce beast that barred the shortest way up the fair mountain." Once again, the poet invites us to discover and be moved by the creative power of his poetics of the gaze. The incipit or beginning of the episode of Beatrice meeting with Virgil took shape with the luminous image of Beatrice's eyes that surpassed the splendor of the stars. And the explicit or ending of the episode we now see expressed before our eyes by the luminous image of Beatrice's gleaming, tearful eyes. Again, we witness the power of the gaze to at once complement and transcend with its silent language the power of words, of language, in this case as a sign of Beatrice's love for her friend and not the friend of fortune. As we are implicitly invited to see side by side the two images of the splendor of Beatrice's eyes, we are moved by the shift from the pure light or splendor of her eyes to the light that coincides with her eyes filled with tears. So the light now is intensified by the tears, which is interesting. So there's new pathos expressed. "Gli occhi lucenti lagrimando volse," the original cannot be really translated. A verse marked by the predominance of the liquid consonant L, "gli occhi lucenti lagrimando volse," and thus, to use a technical term, by the creative power of phonosymbolism. Now, I will skip this other page, because we have to be moving. As we see Dante and Virgil walk across the shades, this is now in the Inferno. Virgil is Dante's guide, and they're moving in the realm of where the gluttons suffer the hellish suffering of having perverted the goodness inherited in being nourished by food. So, as we see Dante and Virgil walk across the shades of the gluttons, setting their quote souls upon their empty images that seems like persons. By the way, this I'm skipping the punish these souls lie prostrate, supine, and there's a rain, there's snow, and they lie in filth, which suggests kind of what has been digested, and so now they lie in the filth, which is on a larger scale. This is a hellish scene, and so they've lost their individuality. The human image has been lost, but out of this dark and hellish scene emerges suddenly one figure, the figure of Chacco, a Florentine citizen, fellow citizen of Dante. So now I read the following. "As we see Dante and Virgil walk across the shades of the gluttons, setting their souls upon their empty images that seemed like persons. We are struck by the suddenness with which one of the shades emerges from the multitude of those who share his fate, lying on the filthy ground under a heavy rain, as soon as he sets his eyes on the two wayfarers. And all of those spirits lay upon the ground, says the poet, except for one who sat erect as soon as he caught sight of us in front of him. O you who are conducted through hell, he said to me, recall me if you can. For you, before I was unmade, were made. And I, Dantes, and I to him. It is perhaps your anguish that snatches you out of my memory, so that it seems that I have never seen you. But tell me who you are, you who are set in such a dismal place, such punishment, if other pains are more, none's more disgusting. And he to me, your city, one so full of envy that its sack is always spilled, that city held me in the sunlit life. The name your citizens gave me was Chaco. By the way, onomatopoeic, Chaco reproduces the sound, chuck. But also it meant a hug, a pig. And also is the nickname for Giacomo, Jacques. So we have these names combined into one. As soon as we observe that the soul addresses Dante alone, pointedly challenging him with a touch of self-irony to be recognized, while he instead declares that he recognizes interlocutor as a fellow Florentine, we interpret his sudden awakening in a sense as coming alive or into being against the backdrop of the other unnamed shades that remain supine. As soon as he caught sight of Dante and Virgil, as an unmistakable sign of the solicitude or natural friendship that binds one to his fellow citizen, he reveals his identity as being inextricably linked to his city and its citizens, who named him Chaco. And I explained the nickname. Thus Chaco is both the good citizen Giacomo and an undignified glutton or hog. It is notable that Chaco, before identifying himself, reveals his love for the city by identifying, from an ethical and political perspective, the ills, the envy that perverts its order. He does this adopting a language that allusively is that of a glutton, whose own sack has always spilled. Thus, as he judges his city, he is also judging himself. In him coexists Giacomo, the original good citizen, and the hog. Hence, in this inner conflict, we discover a measure of his anguish and his hell. We can now see in sharper light at once Chaco's authentic love for his city and the perversion of his love by his sin of gluttony in this closing scene evoked by Dante. I should briefly now give you the synthesis. As he's about to say goodbye, so to speak, to turn, and so we have the sense plastically, dramatically, that he's lowering and he's looking at Dante, and so his gaze is now twisted, and then he lies supine. And I suggest this in Dante's the poet, vision, evokes a scene in a tavern on earth, when someone is eating, chuck, and he's seeing a fellow citizen, and then he goes back to his repas, to his dinner. Huge, I imagine, to overeat. And so he's going, but so this is now a hellish scene, which echoes that of hell on earth. So I read the pertinent verses. But when you have returned, says Chaco to Dante, to the sweet world, I pray, recall me to men's memory. I say no more to you, answer no more. Then, says the poet, his straight gaze twisted and awry, he looked at me a while. Then bent his head, he fell as low as all his blind companions. In his prayer to Dante, to be remembered by the citizens of Florence, nostalgically identified with the sweet world, we catch one last glimpse of Chaco as Giacomo, the good, loving citizen. Then, in the image of the silent Chaco, whose straight gaze as a last vestige of his friendly, face-to-face connection to Dante, the fellow citizen, grew twisted and awry. We discern one who has lost his original identity as a member of the city-state of Florence. As we see him turn away speechless from Dante we are reminded of Chaco the hog, who is about to be blinded by his gluttony. As in a tavern scene on earth, he now appears eternally bent on filling his sack until it spills, as he joins all the other blind gluttons. But the crucial moment I now synthesize, as I repeat, the moment when this moment of ineffable goodness still, nostalgia for the good life of a good citizen, when for a moment he looks for a moment at Dante, and then he turns, there's an instant there, just a moment of epiphany, of revelation, of his goodness which he has betrayed, he has perverted. Now we move on. Look at the clock. I will now comment briefly on the episode of Dante's and Virgil's encounter with the souls of the Purgatorio, of the envious. Again, I'll just give you the gist of it to move on to the Paradiso. Again, for brevity's sake. So Dante and Virgil discover in one of the terraces of Purgatorio, it's a mountain at whose summit there's the earthly paradise where Beatrice will appear and so on. And Dante will be like Adam encountering Eve. They look at these souls who are dressed in a color that is livid, that is very similar to the rock, that hardly distinguishable from the rock against which Dante sees them delineated. And their eyelids are sewn by iron wire, so that they are blind. And interesting, this is really medieval aesthetics. If I could imagine the realism of Dante. Their eyelids sewn with wire, so they're blind. As on earth, their eyes, they envied those who were happy. They were happy instead of loving their neighbor. Through their eyes, they loved to see them to experience suffering. They longed for the neighbor's downfall. They rejoiced in the unhappiness of others. So they were blind. So Dante now, as a form of expiation, has them for a time, they have to experience the blindness. Anyway, so this is an interesting, so it's the negation of the gaze. So this is an example. But it's a form of expiation. Eventually they will see the neighbors, they will be freed, they'll climb to heaven. And they'll see the members of the city of God, the blessed, and of course they'll see God face to face. So now we move on to the next. Notice, this makes my son very happy. Because he suggested it correctly to do a little pruning. So I did some pruning. the effectiveness of brevity, you know? So now I move to Paradiso 23rd. It's one of the most beautiful cantos that's been defined. Okay, let us now turn our attention to canto 23rd. Where the episode of Beatrice's smile is woven into the theodrama of the triumphs of Christ and Mary. It's a theodrama. They descend with the angels. They appear, and Christ appears as a sun, brighter than our sun. And Dante gazes upon this theodrama, and then they all return to heaven, and then he's empowered to finally gaze upon the smile of Beatrice and to endure and not be killed. Not be annihilated by that smile. Again, the ineffability of her smile. So, I'll skip that. I think I will read just a few moments from the text. I think the commentary I gave you sufficient, at least to move on. So, and all the seven heavens, says Dante, show to me. So he gazes at the universe, the beauty of the universe. Their magnitudes, their speeds, the distances of each from each, the little threshing floor, that is, our earth is like a threshing, that so incites our savagery, was all from hills to river mouths revealed to me while I wheeled with the eternal Gemini. So now he's in the constellation of Gemini, the constellation under which Dante was born. So Dante believed in the astrology and in the economy of the heavens that contribute to the one's temperament, one's natural gifts. And we still believe that the Gemini, those born under the sign of Gemini, they are creative. their poets, their artists, and so on. So, so now we will. So there's the emphasis on the beauty of Beatrice's eyes. That's our next topic: beauty, and the beauty of the universe. So now I'll skip a few lines and read the following. So he's, you know, he sees Beatrice, with, and that, the poet compares her to a bird at dawn, the mother bird that is expecting, waiting, longing for the sun to rise, so that she can feed the young. But most of all, she will enjoy, will love to see, to focus on, to look upon the fledglings, the little ones in the nest. So I'll read the following and then move on. As does the bird among beloved branches, this is Dante's simile, through the night that hides things from us, she has rested near the nest of her sweet fledglings, and on an open branch anticipates the time when she can see their longed-for faces and find the food with which to feed them, chore that pleases her, however hard her labors, as she awaits the sun with warm affection, steadfastly watching for the dawn to break. So did my lady stand erect, intent, turned toward that part of heaven under which the sun is giving to less haste. And now, as I said earlier, the new sun appears in the triumph. Jesus appears as a sun. And so it is Beatrice who gazes into this new sun, and then invites Dante to in turn gaze at this the theodrama. As I said a moment ago, then after this experience by Dante of this theater, then finally Beatrice says, now you can look at my, and not die, you can look at my smile. But then another image comes to mind that I'll share with you. At one point in the Divine Comedy, in the Paradiso, Dante says, I looked, it seemed that the universe was smiling, all the gleaming, the light of the stars, it seems like a smile. And in fact, we identify smiling with as Dante says in Convivio, in another work, with the scintillation of the soul that comes out. And again, it's a language that transcends words, as we are experiencing smiling right now. Some of us are smiling at one another. It's a kind of a paradise, it's an epiphany. Okay, now, I'm going to come really to a close, and you're going to be happy. We'll skip this. It's a beautiful episode. It hurts. It hurts. It's just, well, but we have to be economic. And now, when he says at one point, it seemed to me her face was all aflame, and there was so much gladness in her eyes, I am compelled to leave it undescribed. Now, we go. Finally, I will not comment, except at the very end, I will read. So allow me to read the final scene from Paradiso, the final moments of Dante's vision of God face to face. This is canto 33, the last canto. The living ray that I endured was so acute that I believed I should have gone astray had my eyes turned away from it, as Nicola quoted a moment ago. I can recall that I, because of this, was bolder in sustaining it, until my vision reached the infinite goodness, all grace abounding, through which I presumed to set my eyes on the eternal light, so long that I spent all my sight on it. In its profundity, I saw ingathered and bound by love into one single volume what in the universe seemed separate, scattered. Beautiful, the image of the book, scattered through the universe. Substances, accidents, and here is the scholastic language of the Middle Ages. Substances, accidents, and dispositions as if conjoined in such a way that what I tell is only rudimentary. I think I saw the universal shape which thou not takes. For speaking this, I feel a joy that is more ample. That one moment brings more, that point, he says, that point, punto. That one point brings more forgetfulness to me than 25 centuries have brought to the endeavor that startled Neptune with the Argos shadow. So was my mind completely wrapped intent, steadfast and motionless, gazing. And it grew ever more enkindled as it watched. Whoever sees that light is soon made such that it will be impossible for him to set aside that light for other sight, as Nicola reminded us a moment ago, because the good, the object of the will, is full gathered in that light. Outside that light, what there is perfect is defective. What little I recall is to be told from this point on in words more weak than those of one whose infant tongue still bathes at the breast. And now, because more than one simple semblance was in the living light at which I gazed, for it is always what it was before, but through my sight, which as I gazed grew stronger, the more he looks, the more his sight is empowered, intensified, that soul appearance, even as I altered, seemed to be changing. In the deep and bright essence of that exalted light, three circles appeared to me. They had three different colors, but all of them were of the same dimension. One circle seemed, reflected by the second, as rainbow is by rainbow. And the third seemed fire, breathed equally by those two circles. How incomplete is speech, how weak. When set against my thought, and this to what I saw is such, to call it little is too much. Eternal light, you only dwell within yourself. And only you know you, self-knowing, self-known. You love and smile upon yourself. That circle which begotten so appeared in use as light reflected. When my eyes had watched it with attention for some time, within itself and colored like itself, to me seemed painted with our effigy, so that my sight was set on it completely. As the geometer intently seeks to square the circle, but he cannot reach through thought on thought the principle he needs, so I searched that strange sight. I wished to see the way in which our human effigy suited the circle and found place in it, and my own wings were far too weak for that. But then my mind was struck by light that flashed, and with this light received what it had asked. Here force failed my high fantasy, but my desire and will were moved already like a wheel revolving uniformly by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. As I pronounce these words, which move me deeply, as you see, I can't help it. As I pronounce these words that speak of Dante's vision of God, face to face, I think of them as an answer to Job, who expressed his longing to see God face to face with these famous words, famous to some of us. This I know, that my Redeemer lives, and he, the last, will take his stand on earth after my awakening. He will set me close to him, and from my flesh I shall look on God. He whom I see will take my part. These eyes will gaze on him and find him not aloof. Thank you for your attention. At my age, I'm only 78. At my age, I'm becoming more fragile. It just happens. It's beauty that makes me weep with joy. Thank you.
Now we have.
Let's listen to our
Peter. I'm just going to go relieve myself.
Yes, so brief break and then Peter Booth.
Thank you all for coming. First, I'd like to thank my beloved spiritual master, Avatar Meher Baba, who introduced me to this wonderful poet. Just get a sip of water. This is a far more intellectual talk, and I apologize for that.
Okay, we can take it.
And intense sight, Nazar in Persian, gaze in English, is at the center of Hafez's cosmology. Although gaze implies a prolonged sight, and anything of a long duration is at odds with Hafez's poetic style and cosmology, as God's limitless creativity is ever-changing, ever-new, and constantly varied. So let's have a look at this. Hafez's conception of existence is monotheistic, but rather than just calling this existence God, he also calls it love. This existence is an uncreated, infinite existence, timeless, dimensionless, without volume, nameless, traceless, it just is. Being uncreated, there is no point of origin, reference point, or benchmark in it. There never was a time when it wasn't, and there never will be a time when it will not be, as there is no time in it. It is not circumscribed by anything. As it is infinite love, it is faced with the problem of having to create a situation or opportunity allowing it to express this nature. Simply, how can it love when there is nothing other than itself? That is, it can't be love unless it can express itself as love. And to do this, it has to have something or someone other than itself to love. But as love is an infinite existence, it is not possible to create or add anything onto it. For if there were an empty space allowing for addition, love would not be infinite. It would be circumscribed by the void where it does not exist, making it finite. There being a lack of space in love's infinity for the addition of creation, then it must be that creation supplants an area of love's existence, elbows it out of the way, as it were. But if this were the case, addition would actually be subtraction, as a line of demarcation would be drawn, separating love's infinity from its creation, and in the process, love would lose its infinity and become finite. You all with me? Hafez makes it clear that this cannot happen, as God is infinite love, is in no way limited, affected, or altered by his apparent creation of creation. That is, although he creates creation, his infinity is not lost. Bearing this in mind, let's see how Hafez describes this creation of apparent separation of love into lover and beloved, allowing love to express its true nature as love. As Hafez's poetic style is extremely subtle, he peppers allusion to his conception of creation throughout his body of work, so we have to draw all of these together to arrive at an understanding. As an entree as to how and why love creates creation, let's start with the beloved's cheek, the beauty mark or mole on it, and the relationship Hafez establishes between this beauty mark, sounds better than mole, and the pupil of the eye. In the process, we will also encounter Hafez's referential poetic style, where referring to and comparing the qualities of one thing establishes at least in part the qualities of another. In this case, nothing is better suited for expressing the infinity of the infinite and how it relates to the finite of creation than the pupil of the eye. The eye's pupil is round, minute, and black, yet it is able to contain vast vistas of sight and the effulgence of light. Hafez makes it clear that the ability of the eye's pupil to contain limitless sight is because it is a reflection of the beauty mark on the beloved's cheek. And by doing this, Hafez establishes this beauty mark as representing all of creation. I'm quoting now, I hold the pupil of my eye dear, as it is a copy of your Hindu beauty mark. Or, this black point that has become the orbit of sight is a reflection of your beauty mark in the garden of sight. Or, the orbit of the sight of the pupil of my eye is your beauty mark. I'm sorry, the orbit of the sight of the pupil of my eye is the beauty mark on your cheek. The value of a priceless pearl, only a pearl knows. To further build this referential context, for the most part, the beloved's cheek represents God's, that is, love's, infinite uncreated being. Quoting, God, to whom in the world can I relate this point? The beloved who is everywhere has not shown his cheek to anyone. Or, both the worlds are a ray of the manifestation from his cheek. I am telling you, the visible and the invisible both. Additionally, the beloved's stature is always presented as being perfectly erect, whereas everything else is curved. May every cypress that appears in the garden be bent in service to your erect stature. And, in ecstasy like a rose along the bank of a stream, I blossomed, for above me the shadow of that erect cypress appeared. Additionally, the beloved's cheek and his erect stature are given a similar status, each representing the infinite uncreated existence of love. Out of desire for that cheek and that erect stature, a spring breeze arose in the meadow from beside the rose and the cypress. Now consider this couplet. On the day before the beginning of time, a black drop fell from your pen onto the moon as the solution to your problem. On the day before the beginning of time, a black drop fell from your pen onto the moon as the solution to your problem. I believe the problem mentioned here is two things. First, how to create separation so that there can be a lover-beloved relationship, and also how to create some degree of relativity, measure, or reflection, or gaze, so that the beloved may be made aware of his infinite attributes. You still with me? All right. Now, taking all this together, and considering again that it is not possible for an infinite existence to create anything, as to do so would actually be an act of destruction rather than creation, that is, existence would lose its infinity, it becomes clear that love as the creator solves this problem by curving or bending its effulgence, much as clear light passing through a prism is bent and produces the illusion of colored substances. The black drop on the moon, the pupil of the eye, and the beauty mark on the beloved's cheek, as all three are black and spherical, suggests that the greater the curving of the effulgence of love, the greater the darkness, the greater the relativity, and the greater the separation, as one would expect if this reading holds true. This increasingly greater curvature spirals down into less and less effulgence until we arrive at the symbol for all of creation, the black drop falling onto the moon, or the beauty mark on the beloved's cheek. This black drop carries this conceit to its height. As being spherical, its curvature is complete, and in being black, there is a complete absence of light. If this is the case, then love's apparent creation has to be a type of optical illusion and not a real existence. As seen here, Hafez says this is the case. I presented this world and the next to my ripened heart. It knew immediately that everything save your love perishes into nothing. This world being the material world and the next world being paradise. And the total production of the created universe is absolutely nothing. Bring wine, for everything in the material world does not exist, with wine being Hafez's symbol for uncreated infinite love. To return to an overview for a moment, as love is the only existence, that is the primal force, it is not possible for love to express anything that is not its nature as love. Or, to put it another way, whatever love expresses is an expression of its true nature. It cannot express something that it is not because, as we have seen, and being infinite, it is the only thing that exists. Simply, in Hafez's cosmology, there is only love. Nobody's asleep yet. I'm not succeeding. Bearing this in mind, let's review for a moment the history of the different presentations of the final manifestation of love found in classical Persian mysticism. First, you have an eternal sojourn in the ideal created state of paradise. For Hafez, paradise is a bit like a retirement home where lovers are put out to pasture after love is through playing with them. Or, perhaps if he were alive today, an upscale gated community where the residents pass their days in divinely sanctioned boredom, maybe even with St. Peter as the security guard. As love cannot create anything outside of itself, and as love is doing this to express its true nature, then this, if we accept it, must be what love is. Hafez totally rejects this. Then you have the burst the bubble conception of the final state of the lover, popularized by Rumi, where the separation producing the individuality of the lover is compared to the formation of a bubble on the shoreless ocean of God's infinite existence, only to have the bubble burst, representing the lover's reunion with his source. This is a bit like that great heroine of many feminists, the female praying mantis, who, after making love, devours her mate. If you think about it, this is not a particularly loving end to this thrilling romance, with the beloved essentially saying, "You were enjoyable to be with for a while, but well, as cool as you are, there's nothing about you to justify keeping you around for all eternity, so poof." Hafez also rejects this, as in this case, love's essence would be one of rejection rather than compassionate, loving acceptance. Bearing this in mind, to begin to arrive at Hafez's presentation of the final state of the lover, consider these descriptions of the fall. Trying to kiss the bait of the beauty mark on his cheek, I fell into the trap of his curls. Or, I was a bird of the spirit, singing from the top of Gabriel's tree in paradise. In the end, I was cast into the trap by the seed of the beauty mark on your cheek. Or, I was an angel, and paradise was my abode. It was Adam who brought me into this ancient flourishing ruin. At first glance, it appears we have encountered a variation of the Judeo-Christian description of the fall. Reading more closely, however, reveals that paradise and Hafiz's conception of existence is a very inferior temporary state, as it is among the realm of the created, and as such can have no lasting existence. In fact, like the material world, it is absolutely nothing. I'm quoting, "In the season of the lily and the rose, the world has become the highest paradise. But to what avail when there is no eternity in it? In the season of the lily and the rose, the world has become the highest paradise. But to what avail when there is no eternity in it?" So the fall of the soul from the realm of paradise into the trap around the seed of the beauty mark on the beloved's cheek, this beauty mark representing the entire realm of creation and separation, is actually beneficial, as the end result for the soul that passes through this realm in Hafiz's cosmology is union with God, rather than a sojourn in the illusory created realm of paradise that was the soul's residence before the fall. Reading further, we find that this black drop, rather than being a sinful flaw, as many might assume, is actually sacred. That is, creation is sacred. And rather than the soul's fall into this realm being the result of the expulsion from paradise due to sin, it is actually because the soul, or God as love, cannot resist the beauty of the lover-beloved relationship, represented by falling into the trap of the beauty mark, as this fall allows love to express and experience its true nature. Remember, arriving at an understanding of love's true nature is what we are up to. Elsewhere, Hafiz provides another description of the fall, this time using a grain of sand that forms a pearl. "Love is the grain that forms the pearl. I am a diver in the ocean of the tavern, descending to see where I come up." If there is any relationship between the beauty mark and the grain, each causing the descent of the soul, then it is love that brings about creation. The soul's descent into this creation, resulting in the ultimate expression of love's nature, the creation of a unique individuality completely united with God. The same process is expressed in two different ways. I'm going to skip that. Returning for a moment to the black drop on the moon and the images associated with it reinforces our reading. The black drop falling on the moon symbolizes that this black drop is illusory, as the moon generates no light by itself, but merely reflects the sun. However, as is seen in many places, the light produced by this black drop and the moon is far greater than that produced by the sun. When the sun saw that black beauty mark, it said to its heart, "How I wish I was that fortunate Hindu." Hindu conveying the sense of slave. If the love-nurturing moon fully adorns itself, the sun of the east, out of jealousy, will tear open its cloak. If the love-nurturing moon fully adorns itself, the sun of the east, out of jealousy, will tear open its cloak. This couplet also being a beautiful description of the sun rising. And Hafiz, the end result of the soul's passage through the blackness of separation is the annihilation of just that, any separate existence. expressed as Fana by the Persian mystics as well as Hafiz, these couplets expressing the total annihilation of separate existence and the resulting union between lover and beloved are among the most beautiful in Hafiz's poetry. Like the candle of the morning, my life will end when it is lit by the sun of his compassion. Or, no one from any side has seen the like of the one in whose search I have vanished from myself. Or, I swear by your soul, my sweet idol, that like a candle, my only intention in these dark nights is my own annihilation. Or, I asked, when are you going to bestow your grace on this weak soul? He answered, when your soul is no longer in the way. In Hafiz, after annihilation, there remains a speck of dust on the beloved's foot, representing the lover who remains after this annihilation has taken place. This speck appropriately contains a light as bright as the sun's. And again, we have another variation on the minute pupil of the eye, effulgence of light metaphor. Quoting again, although the sun of the heavens is the light of the world, it is the dust of your feet that gives the eye of the sun its brightness. Although the sun of the heavens is the light of the world, it is the dust of your feet that gives the eye of the sun its brightness. It is natural to think of this couplet as hyperbole, but when we consider it in the overall context of Hafiz's cosmology, it becomes obvious that it is not. For the end of the spiritual journey is, as is seen throughout Hafiz, this speck of dust on the door of the beloved's threshold or on his foot. Yet despite its minuteness, this speck of dust, as we see in this couplet and elsewhere, contains an effulgence far brighter than the sun's. Indeed, it is this speck of dust that is the source of the sun's light. To understand how this is possible, let's go back for a moment to the beginning of this talk and consider that again, as love's existence is uncreated, there is no point of reference or benchmark within it to measure anything. That is, from love's perspective, there is no size. Or to put it another way, everything is exactly the same size. This means that a speck of dust on the beloved's foot is the same size as the universe, which also means that the universe is actually a speck of dust. Now, and this is the important part, as everything created is absolutely nothing, nothing has the power to in any way divide the infinity of existence. To do this, it would have to be something, and it is not something, it is nothing. What this means is that infinity is infinitely present in creation, no matter how apparently minute that form may be. So now back to our speck of dust resting on the beloved's foot. I believe that Hafiz uses a speck of dust to in part express that all of the curved reality of the illusory creation, once producing darkness, has been removed, and only the uncurved, straight, or perfectly erect effulgence of God now remains. A similar expression, are you all brain fried by this point? You're all right?
Okay,
let's see if this fries your brain. A similar expression is found in another of Hafez's vast metaphors, that of circumference and pivot. As Hafez presents it, one circumference pivot is another pivot circumference, and this continuum extends in both directions to infinity, with no member of the continuum, from the viewpoint of reality, being different in size from another, and with every member fully containing, or better yet, unable to limit God's infinity. So the pivot cannot be a relative point. So the pivot cannot be a point relative to or defined by circumference. The pivot can only be an infinite, uncreated point of minute infinity in the limitless existence of love, imbibed with all of the attributes associated with this. And the circumference can only be the turning of anything that appears to exist by the curving or bending of love's effulgence at the pivot. This pivot-circumference relationship is often used to express the state of God realization, with one foot in reality and the other an illusion. When considering this, we again arrive at another of Hafez's favorite metaphoric constructs that we mentioned before, the perfectly erect stature of the beloved, representing the pivot, compared with the curved form of everything else, representing creation, or again, the unmanifest cheek of the beloved, representing the uncreated, with the beauty mark on it, representing the circumference and all of creation. To review for a moment, we're almost done. To achieve the lover's God-realized state, God creates an illusory separation with his limitless unity, dividing himself into lover and beloved, so that love can experience its true nature through expressing love. He creates this separation by curving his effulgence, providing relativity, volume, and substance, and in the process, creating an apparent other, that is, the lover. Again, as an analogy, think of pure light passing through a prism. God then annihilates this curving and substance, and lover and beloved are reunited. In Hafez, this annihilation, however, is not the annihilation. I'm sorry, in Hafez, this annihilation is the annihilation of the relativity and curving that brings the lover into existence. It is not the annihilation of the lover's individuality that his passing through creation creates. The final state of love's expression, then, is that the infinite individuality of the lover is maintained after annihilation. In short, the highest expression of love, the only possible expression of love, as is found in Hafez's poetry, is for love to create another perfect in composition without any bonds or conditions, infinite and completely eternally free. Now it appears we have finally arrived at the conception of love in Hafez's poetry, and one now might expect a final terminus stasis, or eternal state of rest, much like that found in the state of paradise that Hafez rejects. In fact, in Hafez, everything, including this reunited God-realized state, exists within the realm of love's unceasing creativity and limitless giving. When we consider this unceasing creativity, it becomes obvious that love is not going to create, indeed cannot create, anything that is not a pure expression of its nature as love. Love as nothing other than... Let me do that again. When we consider this unceasing creativity, it becomes obvious that love is not going to create, indeed cannot create, anything that is not a pure expression of its nature as love, as nothing other than love exists. When we consider love's limitless giving, it is obvious that love will want to give everything that it has to its created being, including the most priceless possession of all, an infinite, unconditional, unique existence. For love to want it to have anything less than this would make the unconditional, infinite giving of love conditional and finite. And Hafez makes it clear that finite, conditional giving has nothing to do with love. That is, you cannot give a part of the infinite, as this would be finite, and the finite is totally different from love's infinite nature. In short, love can only give the infinite. Now, the created being that has gained a complete and separate individuality by passing through the sacred darkness of creation is also nothing other than perfect and complete love. So it too will want to give everything it has, that is, its very existence, as this is all that it has to the beloved. Seen another way, there are now two beloveds and two lovers, both lost in the limitless giving of each to the other. Yet despite this limitless giving of the one existence to the other, no matter how infinite this giving becomes, each continues to exist. This realization in the essence of love's being, that the limitless giving of itself can never fully annihilate it, produces in love a limitless humility, this humility being the essential nature of love to completely give itself to another individual being, and the created being, now perfect love, to do exactly the same. It is as if each says to the other, "How is it possible for you to love me so much?" These images of the limitless humility love experiences when it comes face to face with itself are found throughout Hafez and form the ultimate and final expression of the two lovers and the two beloveds, enthralled by their eternal, endless, limitless giving. As Hafez says, "O nightingale of the morning, rejoice, for your heart has become united with the rose, and all of the love songs in the meadow are now yours." No matter how many lovers his limitless beauty kills, another group will rise their heads from the unseen. Or, to put it another way, the one whose heart has lived for love never dies. Our eternity is recorded in the register of the universe. Thank you. But wait a second! If each one of us is like love, love being the only thing we can possibly be, an infinite, uncreated being, then what the hell are we doing sitting here? That is, our becoming God realized cannot be a part of a process, as process implies an imperfect beginning followed by a perfect end. not to mention that it also implies the production of something. And as we have seen, before love's infinity, nothing can be produced. Our momentary illusory existences, then, must be the price we have to pay for our infinite love to know and express itself. Hey, that's it. Thank you for coming. Thank you very much.